You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 308.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. Today, finally, joined once again by Aaron. Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's been a little while.
It has been a little while. I've been having a good time. I actually just got back from an incredible concert of a trio up in New Canaan. They were called Trio Fandolin. It felt very fancy, very like, you know, very kind of very uplifting music. It was like one violin, one viola, one cello. And they were doing music from Ukraine, from Armenia, from all over the world, and it was quite good.
I was just going to toss out that we may be discussing some popular music a little bit later on.
Oh, nice!
But not what typically gets played on that kind of trio.
Type of music is that? Is that that's not classical? That's like
You could use the term chamber music probably to encompass it, because classical is really more of a period.
Yeah.
The chamber is more of kind of a style or a format.
I felt like they were almost recording for a movie score or something like that, which is a different type of music. But today we're going to talk about the fourth turning once again. This is, and I just finished reading the book. This is a new book that came out by Neil Howe. The Fourth Turning is here. Now, we discussed his earlier book called The Fourth Turning. That came out in 1997 with William Strauss. So they were talking about the future there. And they were saying, wow, the 2020s are going to be a real turbulent decade. And they were saying this in 1997. Well, here we are in the 2020s. Some of his predictions came true. Not all of them, but enough to be interesting. So he decided to write a new book called The Fourth Turning, which seems like a culmination. It is 450 pages, seems like a culmination of all his work. He's a demographer, a political prognosticator, Neil Howe. And I bit the bullet and I read all 450 pages. So here you go. You can ask me questions about it. But first of all, let's talk about a little bit about what the fourth turning here is, because this is Strauss Howe generational theory. And I'm trying to think of how to introduce this. We have talked about this before, particularly in episode 172 and 173, when we reviewed the older fourth turning book. But it's really a cyclical idea of history. And I first came across this because originally you and I, Aaron, we were talking about, and we probably should dive into this stuff a little more in the future. We would always try to make predictions on a technological basis. And so right. We would use frameworks like the Gartner Hype Cycle, and we would use frameworks like the Law of Accelerating Returns, right? Ray Kurzweil. But I didn't have the tools to talk about social change. And I was like, well, that's the way it is. We should just keep it separate. We're the tech guys, you know, leave social change to other people, or just, you know, being like, hey, can't predict it at all, so don't even bother. But eventually I came to the conclusion that no, social change is a big part of it interacts with technology in a very fundamental way, and you can't ignore it if you want to talk about it.
And vice versa.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to talk about social change, you can't ignore technology, which actually I think Howe should go into more technological change in his book, but that's a little perhaps criticism that we could talk about later. And if you want to talk about technological change, you should not ignore social change. Fourth turning, Strauss-Howe generational theory, gives a really good framework for talking about social change, and really he's talking about generations and how different generations of people view the world differently. And it's funny because you think, well, why should I view the world exactly the same as someone who was just born the same time as me, you know? And so it's not that you view the world the same way. You might have different religions, you might have different outlooks on life. You might have different personalities, but you lived through the same events. You heard the same messages growing up. You heard the same commercials growing up. Now, you might not like the messages that society was giving you growing up. You might reject them, but you still had to contend with them no matter what. So there's kind of like a shared language between everybody.
Common exposure. I mean, a microcosm of that would be, folks who whether we're talking about, World War II or Vietnam or more recently the global war on terror, people who actually were in the armed services and fought overseas in these events, there's a certain camaraderie that they have with other folks who were there because, they have a very distinct shared experience, which in that case is not necessarily shared with their contemporaries who were not in that segment of the population. And it creates a certain divide, but also a much stronger bond between those people because of what they share there.
Yes, and not just political and war, but also cultural and particularly pop culture and artistic trends as well. So, for example, if you were in the silent generation. As like I'm thinking, perhaps my grandmother was. You would have been a young adult in the 1950s when the big names would have been Frank Sinatra or Elvis, right? And you remember that as a young adult. Now that's very different. Yeah, we could go online. We could go online and hear those things. We still hear those are such big names. You still hear them in movies and stuff. But we weren't around when those people came out. We had a whole different set of cultural phenomenon as young adults. So it does really provide a shared language, and also just like and this is a big part of the equation, how children are raised. Now, you might look across the world and across the country and say, well, children are raised very differently, but it turns out like the experts that tell you how to raise your children and the kind of orientation of the schools at the time. And even if you are like homeschooled, it doesn't matter because you're still kind of, you've got your cohort that you still have to contend with. If you're 8 years old, you have to care how all the, I don't know if you necessarily care how all the other 8-year-olds are raised, but how they're being raised is affecting you directly, that your parents can't really do much about. So why does this create cycles? And I think the reason is that, and this has been noticed for a long time. It's not that Strauss and Howe made this up. They kind of refined the theory a little bit, which in a way that's like helpful to put it all together, but it might not be the only way to refine it. But it's been mentioned by the ancient Greeks, the Etruscans, the Romans, and more concretely by, I think it was a 14th century Arab writer called Ibn Khaldun, who said, the future is the same as the past. And they basically said that these cycles are about the length of a lifetime. So they'll be about 80 to 100 years. And that's called the saeculum. And what happens is a generation will raise the next generation, depending upon the generations above them. Usually when you're in your childhood, there are three generations above you. And then there's elders who could be very old. And they're actually very interesting as well, because what are they called? Late elders, I think he called them. Elderly elders. You've lived you've already lived beyond the full saeculum. So you've come back full circle.
They're starting to see repeats.
Yeah, and they actually have very interesting things to say. And so he got into some of that as well. I found that part of the book interesting. But usually there are not as many of them around these days. By the time you get to the... Now, these days, Howe says the cycle might be getting longer because people are living longer and they're hanging on to cultural and political significance a lot longer as well. We see this in Congress, and I probably don't have to make that argument. But yes, so Generations raise the next generation kind of reacts to the events and the attitudes of the previous generation, and that causes this, what ends up being a cycle of about 80 to 100 years. So one prime example, a good way to think about it is, let's say one generation is shaped by fighting and winning a great war, tired of fighting that war, they know what they fought for, they don't want to get into another war. So the attitudes of that generation, they're going to have one attitude raising their kids. Next generation, they have no memory of this. And so they're going to interpret events. And it's not that they're not going to listen to the lessons from their elders at all, but they're going to interpret them very differently than people who lived through it. And so to make that more concrete, we have lost the World War II generation over the last few years. And so that might affect the way people are interpreting events today. And not only have we lost the World War II generation, but anyone our age, millennials, younger, we were not raised by people who remember World War II either. So it's getting deeper and deeper into the past. So you posted this overly simplified version. Tell me about that, because I think that's more easy to reference.
I think a lot of people may have seen this in one form or another, but it's kind of memeified as hard times create strong men create good times create weak men create hard times, and then you loop back over again.
Yes, I keep thinking like, you know, okay, we grew up in good times, it's made us weak, and I'm like, okay, times are getting hard, let's get strong. And then I realize, oh, no, we don't get strong. We have to wait until the next generation.
Would we be in the hard times, or would we be the weak men creating the hard times?
It's unclear. So I should point out that in Strauss, How Generational Theory, they don't they never talk about strong men or weak men. They don't even talk about hard times or easy times. They're just different. Obviously, a fourth turning, which we're in now, which is the crisis time, could be very hard.
Crisis doesn't sound easy.
Yes.
It's not smooth sailing.
But you could have hard times in other times as well, and you could have parts of the fourth turning that are not so bad. They don't create much of a moral judgment on the times and the generations as some people would like to do. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're about to touch on the generational types, the names that he granted to them. You know, sure, hero and prophet have strong positive connotations to them, but nomad and artist don't really carry negative connotations either. So they're generally, you know, neutral or positive, it doesn't come with a baked in value judgment.
And what's interesting is that for every turning, all of these things, like, you know, everyone kind of participates to create the turning. It's not like
they're four generations around at any given time. It's just that they're in different stages of the upswing, downswing in their dominance or their role in society.
Right. And they're
when
creating
a particular turning occurs.
They're creating that. Right. So here are the four generation types. We'll go through them in order, although I don't really know if there's an in order, but, you know, let's see. So there is, so the first, in cyclical order. So we'll start with the prophet, which is what he starts with. That is the first generation type. They're called prophets because during the awakening, they're young adults. These are people who are, this is the boomers. They're born after the Great War and after the Great Crisis. Then after them comes the nomads, which I think comes from like the biblical story where it's like, okay, after the Great Crisis of the Exodus, now we have the wandering in the desert. And the golden calf or whatever, that's the nomad. So that's Gen X, and we're going to talk a lot about Gen X today because they're really interesting. These are people who are today in their 40s and 50s, and who were born probably in the 60s and in the 1960s and the 1970s, and they tend to be a lot more cynical than the generation above them. They tend to be a lot more individualistic. And interestingly enough, the previous nomad generation is called the Lost Generation. They were the generation that fought in World War I. In Europe, they were literally lost because a lot of them died. But in America, they were people who were born in the late 1800s. So that would include my great-grandfather, who I met when I was very young, who was born in 1899. He might have been too young to fight in World War I, or just barely. But he didn't. But, you know, a lot of the people who – World War I veterans were not treated the same way as World War II.
Was he already in the States at that point?
Oh, yeah. He was born in the States.
Well, yeah, and our the scale of our involvement in World War I was significantly less than we would see in the next World War.
Well, if I remember correctly, and I hope I'm getting my history right, after World War I, which is later on towards the fourth turning, they had like the bonus army, which was a bunch of World War I veterans were not happy with the deal that they had gotten. So
I thought the bonus army was Civil War veterans, but I could be mixing things up.
Now I have to look it up to make sure I'm getting it correct. But the bonus army was a group of 43,000 demonstrators, 17,000 veterans of U.S. involvement in World War I's who gathered in Washington in 1932. Okay, so yes, these would have been a lot of Lost Generation folks. And they were also the folks who were, you know, in the 1920s, involved in possibly the illegal liquor trade or,
flappers, perhaps.
In the speakeasies. Yeah, yeah. Gen X is cool. Our nomads are cool. I like them. They're kind of the Han Solo of the group. So we're going to talk about them a bit. The next is the hero generation. Now, that's us. That's also the generation that fought in World War II. They usually don't feel up to the task of doing what the last one did, but that's actually quite common.
Now, does he use the term the greatest generation to refer to that hero generation?
No, he uses the term the GI generation.
That's a little bit more neutral sounding.
Right. And then after that, you have the artist generation, which is the generation who remembers the crisis times, but they grew up in them. So their memory of the crisis times is, adults are really, really concerned, and you better listen to them because some crazy stuff is going down. So the current artist generation, he's actually calling Homelanders. Gen Z, he actually thinks is just like, you know, the media wants to jump the narrative of the new generation, but the Gen Z today is simply just the younger millennials, whereas we're the older millennial. Essentially, these are people who grew up in the wake of 9/11 and COVID and everything in between, and just, you know, basically are like, you know, kind of this generation is often like, they're the most controlled as kids. Maybe that's kind of a negative way to put it, but they're the most they have a childhood where it's like you really have to behave. And so they're kind of like the very well-behaved.
Right. The polar opposite of the kind of Gen Z latchkey child stereotype.
Well, you mean Gen X?
I said Z. I was looking at Gen X. Yes.
Right. Exactly. And so that kind of makes sense because we grew up in a world where it was that whole between the latchkey and the masked kid. We grew up kind of in between that where, the rules on kids were tightening. And I definitely saw that growing up, and I just thought that was always the way it was. It was just,
Were becoming increasingly scheduled and coordinated.
Yeah, and I just thought that's the way society moves. But no, it's because we were actually in the really hard part of the pendulum at back then, which is really interesting way of putting it. So those are the four generations. Artist generations. Artist is a really strangely named one. They are often, they are economically collectivist, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, socialist.
So would the previous artist generation, would that be the silent generation?
Yes. People who grew up, so like my grandparents, some of my grandparents, I don't know how old your grandparents were, they remember World War II, but were too young to fight in it.
I think my grandmother was in her early teens during the war.
Right, right. So your grandmother, same as mine, probably grew up, you might often think, well, if Gen X was latchkey, then back then they must have been really latchkey. But actually, no, it turned out that the pendulum was kind of the other way. Now, obviously, technologically, back then, the kids were going to be out, and you're not going to necessarily know where they are. So in one sense, they had more freedom than today. But it was definitely more of at least according to this book, it was more of a society where, no, you had to make sure, you know, the kids were a little more controlled than they were more controlled in the 40s than they were in the 70s, and then less control, and then more controlled again in the 2020s. And oftentimes it's the nomads raising the art. So it's not like one generation always raises the other. Usually one generation is raised by the two generations above them. The Gen X will often remember being kind of having too much freedom, and they're like, "Oh, we don't want our kids to have that." So they raise artists, and artists often, don't want to be raised that way either, and so they overcorrect on the other side. That's one pendulum, and so this theory has many different pendulums. That's one pendulum that I think is probably the most interesting and probably something that everyone can grasp. Okay, so these four generation types are always around, but it depends on who's the oldest, who's the youngest. You always have a prophet generation followed by a nomad, followed by a hero, followed by an artist. You can't go backwards, okay? Right. You only go forwards. If you want you have to wait for the pendulum to go full swing. So the first turning is a high that's right after the war. That's in the latest one, you could think of 1950s America. It wasn't only the 1950s, but so who's the oldest then? The oldest would be the nomads. So at that point, it was the lost generation was in charge. Harry Truman was a good example of that. Whereas the previous prophets were fighting World War II as like a great, the way he put it was like, it's a great battle, moral battle between good and evil. Whereas Truman just gets in, he's like, all right, we're going to drop a couple nukes and call it a day, kind of a thing. So
you made a comment earlier about you can't skip a generation. You can go from nomad to artist.
Sometimes you could skip or accelerate, but you can't go back.
Okay, so yeah, you can't go backwards, but you could move forward a little bit faster, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah.
And we've talked about, you know, cyclic and roughly 80 to 100 years, but there's not, and we, I think we talked about this the first time through, but there's not a hard and fast, like it's got to be 20 years of this and then 20 years of this. There's a little bit of a stretch accordion, nature to
exactly
to where those divisions fall.
And he talks about this lag where there's like a period of 3 or 4 years when the new generational arrangement is in place, where you're still kind of falling on old habits until you realize, wait a minute, those other people are not there anymore. So, and then a lot starts to change all at once. So it starts with the high where, you know, the oldest are the nomads, followed by the heroes that just won the war in midlife, artists as young adults, and then the prophets are little kids. So they're not in the equation. Then you move into, and so usually society has a very positive outlook at that point. Then you move into the awakening, which is kind of a spiritual and cultural upheavals, which usually include political upheavals as well, but they're not overturning the whole political system. They're more like, they more go along with like the cultural changes.
So this would be kind of the 60s and 70s countercultural movement in the U.S.
And I think it's actually, he places it from like 1963 all the way to kind of like the mid to late 80s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's longer than you think. Some good 80s music, I suppose. Although, interestingly enough, he puts the Reagan Revolution as part of the awakening. It's not just the hippies. It's also, you know, there's also the evangelical movements as well. So for all these things, it's not just this right wing dominant or left wing dominant or traditionalist dominant or radical dominant. There's kind of a two sides.
The whole society is swinging together in
exactly
a particular direction. It just manifests differently in different, you know, parties or segments or sectors.
Yeah. So that's why he can say, hey, in this fourth turning, we can't tell you whether red America wins or blue America wins. We could just tell you how they're going to fight each other, you know, or how they're going to relate to each other as this goes on. So awakening occurs, cultural upheavals, then you finally get tired of that. So that's the prophets are young adults. They're taking part in this awakening as young adults. The artists are also taking part in this awakening as midlifers. One interesting fact that I remember from the book is that, you know, after World War II, the heroes, the GI generation, they come home, right? And they start having lots of kids. They're tired of this wartime stuff. They start having kids, you know, and you get the baby boom. The artist generation, the silent generation who were too young during World War II, Now they turn 20 right after the war, right? They start marrying and having kids as well. So you have two generations having kids a lot at the same time to produce the boomer generation. Hmm. This is kind of borrowed from both generations, which is actually something similar that might be happening in our future. So I guess the GIs, a lot like us, the millennials, waited longer to get married and have kids. But at the time, and this might not repeat, but at the time, the silent generation got married and had kids very young. And as a result, if you look 20 years down the line, the divorce rate went up quite a bit. And a lot of the divorce laws were changed. He paints us millennials. This has been true for me, not necessarily, but like as being a lot more, being all for marriage and as an institution, but being much more cautious than the previous generation. Whereas, you know, maybe the nomad generation might have been a lot more skeptical of
that. That's certainly the impression that I've gotten. However, I wouldn't necessarily have attributed that to a millennial thing as much as I'm in a, you know, 4-year college grad bubble, which is a socioeconomic indicator. Tends to skew much more towards marry later, have children later, compared to the population at large. But also that's a growing portion of the population. I don't know if you could say that is because of or strongly correlated with the turnings. But it certainly happens to be, at least this time around, happening in tandem with it.
Right. Right. So if we go through the awakenings, right? Hi, everyone's raising kids in the awakening. Everyone is having is involved in cultural upheavals. What happens to raising the kids? Just let the kids do whatever they want. And that produces the nomad generation. So they become young adults. The awakening kind of sputters out, and you have this unraveling, which I don't really like that name because, you know, the 1990s were pretty good, as were the 20s, but it's really a time where, okay, we've had political unity, we've had the awakening that kind of is table stakes for the new culture. Now the unraveling is, I guess, it's the unraveling of the institutional the institutional consensus from the high, I suppose. So, like, you know, people are kind of off doing their own thing. And they often say, like, unravelings are a great time to have, like, a frenzy of innovation with, like, new startups, new technology.
Yeah, so, I mean, a way to, that you could couch that is that our latest unraveling kind of coincided with the fall of the Soviet Union. And so all of a sudden, a force that has for basically two generations focused a lot of our national and international efforts, this conflict of ideals, having a concrete enemy, it's gone now. And now that we don't have that unifying focus, it makes sense that things would start to kind of unravel and fall apart, and we'd find other things to fight among ourselves over.
It is, yeah, it's really interesting. And so one thing that people like to do with this is they like to quibble over the dates that the different things start. But you make a good point, because Neil Howe puts, I don't know exactly when he puts the end of the second turning, sometime in the mid-80s. Certainly the fall of communism has to be a very important event, and I'm sure he would agree, at the beginning of the latest unraveling. So basically the latest unraveling, we heroes are kind of too young to remember it. Nothing is really settled. There's wars and stuff, there's political debates and stuff, but nothing really gets settled during the unraveling. And then finally, the prophets, the boomer generation, become the new elders, and then you move into a crisis mode where they're like, all right, it's the fourth quarter of our lives, at least. Let's bring it on. Let's bring on the great, good and evil fight. And so that puts us as young adulthoods kind of in the crosshairs of that. I'm sort of interpreting it in a certain way. I'm sure it could be interpreted in many different ways. And then the new artist generation is born, and they're kind of they're living amidst this crisis. And the nomads, the kind of Gen X people, are raising the new kids, and they're also kind of they're the ones making the kind of decisions during this time. They're the generals. They're the doers. They're the practical ones that are putting everything into effect.
So they may not be the levers of power, but they're the ones executing the.
Well, executing could be, yeah. They don't have as much power because they're kind of not a dominant generation usually. But they are. There is power in being the one executing everything. I mean, I wouldn't say that.
Sure.
Eisenhower had no power during World War II. But he wasn't the one who was, and he had a lot of a moral influence as well, I'm sure. But, he wasn't the one defining the great moral battle at the time. I don't know. I remember all the examples that are given here. You could probably quibble about whether they're good examples or not, but I'll use them. Okay. So
one thing that you mentioned in passing was that we could see some departure from this in the sense of things being sped up or condensed in how quickly we move through a phase or how long a generation may actually be on the map there. Right. One of the other things you mentioned in your notes was that departures from this or conflicts here could come when societies who are in different swings of their pendulums interacting with each other, and I don't know, did they address did he address in this latest book whether we are at an end of that in a society that has become almost completely globalized. Can a case where, Europe and the U.S. are on different timelines. They're in different turnings right now, and so you can't map directly between them. Given where we are now in terms of the global economy, society, is that over? We see a significant fracturing, or could that still be happening today?
Yes, you did talk about the French Revolution and how at the time, like, Europe was a little bit behind the Anglosphere, Britain and the U.S. However, my impression, and I can't, you know, I read the whole book, I internalized it. I'm not sure I can get every quote exactly, but my impression of what he's saying is that this may have reset everyone on the same timeline, thanks to World War II. But we only have one data point, so we don't really have enough. We can't really say right now.
Yeah, I mean, because tell me to hold this thought if it's appropriate. But I'm curious: was there anything that he called out specifically that, oh, we got this wrong in the first book, and I'm not just elaborating on the theory; I need to correct something or reverse something we laid out there.
Oh, interesting. No, I don't think I remember that.
Everything he said before holds up. He's just got another 20 years of insight to add on to it.
I guess so. Yeah. And so, right, you talk about like expanding and contracting timelines. What's interesting is, you know, that the Civil War saeculum is kind of messed up in his theory because what he calls the era of good feelings is a really long first turning that stretches from George Washington all the way through James Monroe. But historically, when we talk about the era of good feelings, that's usually only talking about that last president, James Monroe, which is really interesting because no one ran against James Monroe. But so he considers that one long first turning. Then you have the War of 1812 during the first turning, the Confirmation War. And then after that, you get another high or a continuation of the high because you had just won or, I guess, completed that war. I mean, there's an argument over who won it. But an interesting quote on that where he was like, well, oftentimes at the end of a turning, the prognosticators make really bad predictions about what's coming next because if you're going around in a circle, you usually are looking at like the last 50 years and that often goes in the complete opposite direction than right. what you're thinking. And I think you said at the end of the first turning last time, Thomas Jefferson predicted that pretty soon everyone would be a Unitarian, or I'm not exactly sure what the meaning of what that means, or maybe like a deist or a rationalist or something. I think he said Unitarian, but my interpretation was like, okay, people are kind of people like very kind of rational sort of people have sort of turned against religion maybe, and people want a more kind of metric worldview at the time. And so this is what Thomas Jefferson was predicting a few years later, right into an actual awakening that was like a huge shout.
Putting on my engineer hat, I'm trying to visualize this graphically, and I'm thinking we're talking about a circle. Mm-hmm. And if we want to stretch that circle over an x-axis of time, really that starts looking like a sine wave.
Right,
and
right.
And whatever we're graphing on that, whatever the amplitude of that is, if you're at a point on that sine wave, you are going to be very tempted to make predictions by trying to linearize, you know, where you are and where you've been. And that works great if you're on the upslope or the downslope. But as you start to peak or hit the bottom of the trough, those linear predictions are going to be very poorly fit to what's about to happen.
Yeah, and usually when you're at the peak or the trough, that's usually when you finally become confident to make those predictions. Because when you're in the middle, you're like, oh, well, it's not really a pattern just yet. So that causes a lot of the poor predictions. Does that thing about Jefferson make sense? I'm trying to understand what he means, but it's essentially like this awakening will never happen. And then that's what happened. So, okay. So, let's see, some interesting points in the book that he makes, and you could agree with these or disagree with these. I feel like they're qualitative statements, so it's hard to get data on them, although it's well documented, the book. So maybe there is some data, but he says, you know, young adults in the 60s and 70s, they kind of turned against their parents' music. All new music. Now, there's seeds of the awakening starts in the high, so maybe you can include some music from the 50s in there as well. But that hasn't happened as strongly. There was kind of like a there's kind of a quote like, "Hey, millennials, you know, you might have your own music, and you might not love your parents' music, but we know you still listen to it and keep it around." You know, and whereas the prophet generation didn't do that as much, and so they say we'll be wondering why the next few generations will be so different from us culturally, whereas we kept our parents' music.
Interesting, yeah, I was curious how whether that's a one-sided or a two-way street there. How much is it that the next generation is not rejecting their parents' music, or is it that the parents are not as harshly judging their children's music? Because I'll put on my Angry Man Yells at Clouds hat and say that I think there's a lot of garbage music coming out today that's just empty pop, and that seems like that's what gets the most playtime. Now, granted, I could say that about a lot of things from the 90s and 2000s too.
Yeah.
So there's probably some survivor bias, you know, feeding into that.
So if you may say about it, you're not wrong. So you're right on all counts. You could say that at any time. I mean, like even the 60s and 70s, most of the crap that was produced, we just don't hear anymore. So, I think adults are always going to say, kids these days and their music. But you're actually right, because we are at the complete opposite end of the circle. We're at the complete opposite end of the saeculum from the cultural awakening. So we are, the stuff that's coming out now is not really, it's not really that great. We kind of have to wait a few years for the high, and then we'll start to see some seeds of the next awakening. According to this theory, the music should get better in a few years, or it should start to go in the opposite direction. But throughout our lives, they seem to have gotten worse and worse.
Well, I do remember hearing
that's one of those sine waves that we could be misinterpreting, because we're at the bottom of that in terms of, I guess, music quality.
I remember let's reach back to like Occupy Wall Street, and that seemed like this is the moment where, you know, the protest songs of our generation should be formed and be taken up. And I can't really think of one piece of music or pop culture that came out of that particular movement, that particular time, that has any staying power. So there's something to be said there for we're as much as we think we might be going through these, you know, world-defining or generation-defining struggles, we're not producing the art, so to speak, that goes with that we've seen in some previous generations.
From the
nomads and the artists.
Right. I believe it was Howard Stern who was a boomer who lived through 9/11 and who went from turn the entire Middle East to glass and kill everyone in the region to being anti-war in about 5 years or something. And then I remember him saying, okay, now all of the protest music and stuff is coming back, probably remembering the 60s and 70s. Mm. And it's like, no, I mean, yes, there's music about that. But who are any of them remembered? Like, if you want to think, okay, give me like some music protesting war that's popular, it's not going to be from the last 20 years.
Yeah, it's going to be like 50 years old.
Yeah, exactly. So,
that makes me think a little bit of the, and I don't know how well this extrapolates into current day, into the future, but there was the show MASH, which was ostensibly set in the Korean War, but was really a commentary on the Vietnam War. And how a generation will use not their current conflict or their current war, but they'll comment on that by making art about the previous one, and kind of the cycle of when did when did westerns, when did cowboy movies kind of phase out, and all of a sudden the time was right. It had been long enough that they could start making World War II movies, and surprisingly, we actually seem to be in a resurgence of that. I think is it Spielberg is doing Masters of the Air, and there's some other stuff coming out. I just saw, I want to say it's on Netflix, yeah, that they've taken a lot of footage from World War II and remastered and colorized it. And so I wonder what that signifies, that we're seeing, because World War II movies kind of peaked and disappeared, yeah, but it feels like they're maybe coming back a little bit. But
I feel like they've been done in every turning. Like,
yeah.
Cause,
but why is it that we go back to that particular well rather than, we really haven't seen a resurgence in movies about Vietnam.
Right.
And almost, there was a brief period where you got movies about Korea. That really hasn't resonated through the ages in the way that the other conflicts have.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was the fourth turning crisis. So that's the important one that they're going to make a lot more content about. Mm. It doesn't mean you can't make content about anything else, but it's it's just not going to be the same. Okay. So another interesting thing, a point about Awakening in the book, and maybe this is kind of a scattered but just these are just quotes I remember from the book that were interesting, is that the awakening of the 60s, 70s, and 80s occurred more strongly, Howe claims, in Germany and Italy, the losers of World War II. And he speculates the reason of that is that after being on the losing side of World War II, there was more urgency for cultural change. And also, in the winning side, in the U.S., there is some respect for the World War II generation, even if you're turning against them culturally, whereas in these other countries, those generations are not going to hold any. They're not going
to. They were much more willing to buy into, kind of wipe the slate clean and fill it with something new.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So now I don't know anything about this time period in Germany and Italy, so I can't really comment on it. But it was an interesting, point. Okay. So, another cultural point that I found interesting was, we talked about Boomer and Gen X comedians having a hard time going onto college campuses because back during the Awakening and the Unraveling, you really want to push people's buttons. You really want to accentuate the differences. You really want to push the boundary. We've come to the end of that in terms of our kind of cultural preferences, and now the younger generations don't like that as much. Homelanders are and just like the artists before them, our grandparents might not like that type of comedy. Now, also it's all the woke stuff, but I've
heard some inklings of perhaps a backlash or the pendulum swinging back in the other direction, but it's not in that generation as a whole. It's very much in certain segments of it.
Yeah, and there's always going to be some people who are into that. Interestingly enough, he mentions some Gen X comedy and some movies, which was somebody put on Hot Tub Time Machine on a trip I was on recently. and then I was reading the book, Fourth Turning, which is like a very sophisticated book. It mentions Hot Tub Time Machine. Now, I don't know, do you remember the movie Hot Tub Time Machine that was with John Cusack and Rob Corddry?
I remember bits and pieces of it.
Right. So Rob Corddry kind of carried that movie. That was very funny. So the premise is these are guys in their 40s, so at the time it came out, 2010, it would be Gen X folks, and they're not really happy with where their life has gone. They kind of feel like their youth was misspent, which is a very common theme in for the nomad archetype, and they kind of wish they'd go back in time. So they go back to the old ski place that the old ski mountain in Colorado or wherever it is, somewhere out west, where they used to party it up because nomads in their youth, they're partying it up, right? So they go back there and the place is a complete dump. There's a lot of the places they used to go to are closed and boarded up. There's graffiti everywhere. They go to the hotel that they were at. It kind of smells funny, you know, all that.
The years have not been kind.
Right. So right now they are at the end. They're at the end of the third. So the movie takes place at the cusp between a third and fourth turning. We've unraveled.
So unraveling and about to hit the crisis.
Right. So they go to their hot tub. There's like a dead raccoon in the hot tub, and they're like, yeah. But then it mysteriously gets fixed and cleaned up. So they decide to hop in, and they get taken back in time to 1986, which is the second turning into the third turning. They went back one turning. Okay, so they could do it all over again.
I don't know if that would be the peak or the end of the awakening, but
the end.
Very, very much riding the high of the awakening.
Right. So they're at the end of the awakening. They're at kind of the peak. Gen X is having fun type. It's the mood is very upbeat, jubilant, whereas the mood at the end of the unraveling is very, very negative. And so they can see if they can do their life over again. And so that was an interesting example of kind of a nomad tale, which I thought was pretty funny. My particular favorite is a movie called Grandma's Boy. I think it came out in either 2006 or 2008.
And this is Adam Sandler. Joint, right?
So Adam Sandler's not in it. It's Alan Covert.
Ah, okay.
And so you could say, yeah, he was born in 64. Nick Swardson, he was born in 76. So these are all Gen Xers, right? Peter Dante, born in, doesn't even say where he's born. Man, that guy is completely unknown. All right. So of course, Doris Roberts is the grandmother, Silent Generation, born in 1925. So you can already tell, because the movie's called Grandma's Boy, it's 2006, it's about generations, right?
Yeah, so, and I'm just looking at the, I don't know if it was the poster or the cover from the DVD, but it's, the vibe it gives me is very, like, channeling Animal House.
Oh, that, yeah, the poster does.
Yeah, the artwork on it.
Yeah, I don't think the movie is anything like Animal House. It's basically, they're stoners and their whole job is to test video games. You know, and his reasoning is like, hey, this works for us. We're not here to, we're not like the boomers that either want to go work for a big firm or want to, very idealistic. This is just, it's fun. We make a living. Great. You know, and so they're Gen X video game testers. And there's a scene where they, like, when they take breaks, they go into, like, the video game room and they play against each other. It's kind of fun. They play, there's a Dance Dance Revolution game where they're, like, they're playing against the millennials and winning, basically. And he's like, oh, it says I broke the game. Is that bad? Is that, you know? So they had their boss, who's a boomer, who's always trying to get them to, like, you know, who's always trying to get them to do, like, meditation in meetings to try to, like, find the answer and stuff. He's always trying to find, like, spiritual meaning in everything. And they're just like, this guy, you know, and they're just trying to test the video game or make the video game. And then of course, you know, they have the grandmother who's a Silent Generation and all that. So very interesting. Look at the generations, and kind of a pretty funny movie as well. Sometimes one generation makes a movie about their generation too late, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. I feel, for example, what's another movie like this? Another stoner film. I'm thinking you remember Harold and Kumar?
Yeah.
Go to White Castle. Yeah. That was written by Gen Xers about their own college experience, but I think they did a good job of, like, updating it to 2006, so that it was more millennial focused. So they were more, it was more like trying to find meaning in everything, not just mess around. kind of a vibe to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, that kind of became an instant cult classic.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. And there's examples of movies that didn't work. So I don't have any good examples. I guess one is The Exorcist, where I said, well, remember during the 60s and 70s when an early 60s and 70s, well, okay, Gen X wasn't born in the 80s because that's already millennial at that point. But it was still the second turning in the early 80s. But basically, this whole genre of the kids are evil, like evil children movies.
Well, and that's when the whole I'm blanking on the term for it, but the like Dungeons and Dragons moral panic happened.
Tell me about that. I don't know.
Oh yeah. So Dungeons and Dragons, a classic game. I think it was. I feel bad not having the exact dates in front of me, but I think you know it was launched in like the 70s, but became very popular among school age kids in like the 80s, and there were quite a few people across the country who viewed this as kind of in the same way that some people reacted to like Harry Potter, that like this isn't just a harmless game, this isn't just a story, this is people are learning witchcraft and actually summoning demons, and there were some concerns about people who like kids who disappeared, and that well he actually he went down in the steam tunnels to summon a demon, and it absolutely went overboard, but people were very concerned about this and very much in line with that like the kids are evil kind of yeah. thing, that or maybe not that the kids are inherently evil, but the kids are dabbling with evil.
Right. We should mention Harry Potter, too. But just back to this, like the kids are evil genre. So evil kids are. You could probably find movies made about that every year. But they became popular around that time, and so they were popular. They're making money, so studios kept making them. But at some point, people stopped going in large numbers. So they stopped making them, and then at some point, it was good kids where we need to instill values and So, it's always the nomads are the bad kids, but the millennials are the good kids, kind of a vibe. And then the artists are like the sweet, quiet kids. So there's kind of that progression a little bit. Harry Potter is interesting because that's like a millennial tale, which is, it's almost like, oh, Gryffindor is clearly the hero generation of the Harry Potter houses,
right? You could certainly try and map the different generational archetypes onto the different houses, and that hints at the danger of, well, if you just start dividing things up into four groups, and you can arbitrarily kind of squeeze and map it onto anything to fit
well,
a pattern.
But I don't think it's
this
arbitrary.
Seems to hold up more. It maps over a more consistent historical pattern than kind of the snapshot approach.
I think many like important like cultural and like and literary and religious works that break into four types often map to each other very well. I don't think that's a coincidence. Now.
Yeah, we don't have to dissect it now because I think we talked about it in episode 172 or 73. but Star Wars.
Oh, sorry, it's Harry Potter.
And how has very distinct, different generational roles and how they play into the story format there.
Yeah, no, he totally uses these generational patterns for Star Wars. And notice like The Force Awakens. Well, that's an awakening after the crisis of the original movie. So coming back to... Well, yeah, okay. Well, you know what? I've mapped the four Harry Potter houses onto the four generational archetypes. Why don't we have the audience do it and see if it agrees with...
An exercise to
the audience.
Tweet at us, email us, and let us know what you think, and we'll tell you if you're right or not.
Right. Okay, another interesting point is that the superhero genre was invented in the last crisis, the 30s and 40s. During World War II, a little bit before World War II, that now has unprecedented popularity today. That is the kind of thing that sees a resurgence during a fourth turning.
Yeah, so and that raised the thought for me. Are we seeing kind of a one-to-one mapping of that between the World War II kind of development and rise of the superhero and the popularity of superheroes now, or is there a distinct difference? You know, are we seeing maybe the rise of more of anti-heroes rather than heroes in our superhero media, or is my maybe more simplified view of how hero stories were told, superhero stories were told back then, being ineffectively filtered, that nuance, yeah, or that complexity was always there. I'm not looking back to the right material.
Well, Batman is often a darker kind of a figure. And so my question is, and I don't know this, you know, Batman is really campy in the 60s, then gets darker and darker as time goes on.
Is that a one-way valve, or are we going to see a pendulum swing?
Yeah. Did Batman start in the comics? Because you'd really have to look at the comics, which was the way, it wasn't like movies and TV. It was that was the way people were consuming it in the 30s and the 40s. Was that like a darker, grittier Batman for the times? That would be an interesting
question. I would guess not, but I'm certainly not equipped to answer that. But hopefully some of our listeners have deep knowledge in this field.
Do you think Batman was as campy in the 40s as it was in the 60s? I can't imagine it was.
No, I don't think it was as campy, but I don't think it was nearly as gritty and dark as it has become.
Well, it's but look at the genre, though. It's yeah. You're trying to do it in a comic book. I think here's someone who would have benefited from learning Strauss-Howe generational theory, and that's Joel Schumacher, I think was his name. He was the director of the absolute flop Batman and Robin that came out in the late 90s. That was the only one with George Clooney. And it was basically, he really upped the camp. It was the campiest of camp. And people didn't want that. People wanted the Christopher Nolan version. So he tried to go in the wrong direction.
Yeah, he was leaning into the way things were pointing and didn't anticipate the curve.
Right. So he was trying to go back to the awakening when he was in Unraveling. Big mistake. I suppose that's the case now. And of course, you know, the entire universe of movies about the whole entire Marvel universe all came out in this fourth turning, which is pretty incredible.
Although I've definitely heard it argued that we've hit superhero fatigue, and now is that because they've squeezed the Marvel Cinematic Universe dry, or is it because that we happen to be at that point in the turning where no matter how many movies they'd made by now, we would be seeing people looking for something a little bit different, getting tired of that approach.
Well, if it's the former, then we should see movies that fill the same. And by the former, I mean it's just the Marvel universe.
Yep.
Then we should see similar themed movie that kind of fill that same need for like written about different things. So that would be what to look for. Another thing that gets popular, particularly at the end of the fourth turning, is a lot of discussion, and maybe hopefully he's not just taking this as like one data point in the 1940s, but like a lot of movies and or a lot of media about returning home. So that's something to look for as well. All right, folks, hope you enjoyed our discussion on the cultural side of Strauss-Howe generational theory. This conversation was done at 1 in the morning last night, and it goes on another hour, so we're going to play that next week. And that is on the question of how will this present crisis, this fourth turning, resolve? So a lot of the book talks about that, and so you're not going to, if you like this discussion, you're not going to want to miss next week on our predictions on how the fourth turning heads out. Hope you enjoyed as we approach the end of 2023. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.